a big bang. People cheer when buildings come down as part of a planned demolition, but when things fall apart unexpectedly, there's no applause, just tragedy. America's infrastructure is in trouble. When things falling apart is not a surprise, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, May 22nd. Get out your road maps. We have a list of the most threatened roads, bridges, dams, and levees in the nation. Get out your wallets. The price tag for fixing America's infrastructure is not pretty. Also, Congress and the White House at odds over the farm bill and funding the Iraq war. A catastrophe looms in the Horn of Africa. And FaceTime with an obsessive cartoonist. That and all the news. An oil price surge that drove down the U.S. stock market yesterday is continuing this morning. Oil prices hit a record above $135 a barrel before falling back in Asia. Spiking oil prices were an uncomfortable reality for oil executives on Capitol Hill yesterday. Here's Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin railing against the companies which are raking in record profits.
Does it trouble any of you when you see what you're doing to us? The profits that you're taking, the cost that you're imposing on working families, small businesses, truckers, farmers.
Oil executives who will be in front of the committee again today say the market is working and demand for oil is beginning to fall.
A Senate vote is set today on another $165 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The war funding bill is knotted up in a separate debate over domestic spending programs. Lawmakers may finally unravel the spending bill today. Israel and Syria are holding secret peace talks after an eight-year hiatus. After the disclosure, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice says the U.S. supports the effort.
We knew about these discussions from their inception, and we have been kept informed. We would welcome any steps that might lead to a comprehensive peace in the Middle East.
The talks are being mediated by Turkey. More on those talks coming up.
Secretary General Ban Ki-moon today is getting a firsthand look at the destruction in Myanmar. He's trying to remove obstacles to international aid for cyclone victims. China has revised the earthquake death toll to over 51,000, and almost 30,000 are still missing. Chinese officials announced a $10 billion reconstruction fund and ordered government agencies to cut their spending by 5%. They also ordered a halt to new government construction to aid the earthquake response effort.
And back to those high oil prices, U.S. stocks have had two sessions of steep declines. The Dow fell a total of 427 points over the past 2 days. We're going to be talking with a surveillance cartoonist today. That's right,
surveillance
cartoonist. A cartoonist who wanders the streets of New York and sketches everyone's face. He wants to get 9 million faces into his database before he's done, which caused us to think about a pretty interesting takeaway question for today.
We're asking, in a dream world, what do you wish you could get paid to do?
Our cartoonist doesn't get paid for his passion. What's your unpaid passion, and what would you do if you could get paid? Fill in the blank. In a dream world, I wish I could get paid to do what? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Come on, give us a good one. Or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Your dream job, paid.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. For Democrats, the race to find a presidential nominee, well, that isn't over yet. But that doesn't mean that the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, John McCain, isn't already thinking ahead to who will become his running mate. The New York Times' Adam Nagorny got a jump on that story, reporting McCain plans to meet this weekend with three potential candidates at his Sedona, Arizona ranch. Those three would be Florida Governor Charles Crist, Louisiana Governor Bob Jindal, and Mitt Romney, the former governor of Massachusetts. Adam, good morning. Thanks for joining us. And it seems early, doesn't it, for McCain to be talking publicly in some way, or there to be reports about McCain's potential VP. Is that an indication of how important McCain's pick will be?
I'm not sure it's that early. I think now's a good time to do it. He has a pretty good idea now of who his Democratic opponent is going to be. This is a pretty good moment to begin getting this together. And even though he's beginning to meet with these guys now, it doesn't mean he's going to make his decision now. So it takes a while to do this, so I think the timing is good.
And, Adam, what do these men individually potentially bring to McCain's ticket? Let's start with Romney, who was a rival, his rival in the Republican primary.
Romney ran a pretty good race. He dropped out fairly early. He has management background. He's a former governor. He is from Michigan. He's from Massachusetts, but he was born in Michigan, so he might put Michigan in play. He's just sort of a very confident, sort of managerial kind of guy. So I think that's what he brings to it. The governor of Louisiana, young, dynamic, a new face, a state that Republicans would like to make sure is in play. I think he'd be really good. And, you know, Charlie Crist, Florida, there's no sort of more important state to the Republicans and Democrats in that state. The one thing I'd be careful about is these are the three people that are meeting with him this weekend. It's by far not a conclusive or complete list, so we're not sure who else he's talking to or thinking about. And sometimes these things are done partly for public consumption. Like, I do not think they meant for these names to come out. But sometimes, you know, you can say at the end, well, we thought about this guy, say, from Florida, even though they were never really serious about it. Because of the motions of meeting with him can be very sort of helpful. And I think that might be part of what's going on here.
Well, apparently McCain's characterization of the meeting is he's just having a social weekend with 10 couples that includes these names that you've reported on. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, right. I like it. 3 months before he's about to make his decision or less, he had in his house three of the guys who could be his vice presidential candidate. One thing about this is... you know, McCain's a guy who likes to know people and make sure he's comfortable with them before he sort of works with them, whether they're aides or people he appoints or whatever. And there's a lot of sort of, I think, social interaction is very important here. So I think that's very much what's going on here. He's trying to get a sense of how well he likes them, would he be comfortable with them. And it strikes me as sort of an interestingly competitive weekend. I'd love to be there.
And, Adam, you note that actually McCain has noted that he's assembled a list of about 20 potential running mates. And you got to imagine that the folks who are coming up with these lists are keeping in mind some of the weaknesses that have been identified about McCain's campaign. A, his age, right, which is why these three are all pretty young men.
That's right.
In comparison. And then plus we have the issue of his health. And tell us about how the medical records being released tomorrow, it's sort of the timing is interesting, that finally these long-awaited, at least some of them, long-awaited medical records are going to be released. And then there's this sort of leakage of these men that he's going to be meeting with over the weekend who could potentially be running with him.
You know, here's the thing. As soon as he posted this story on the web yesterday, I got an email from somebody with the Democratic National Committee saying, well, the reason they're doing this is to distract from the release of the medical records. You know, the fact of the matter is, I can tell you this was not an authorized kind of leak, as far as I can tell. I'm like 90% sure of that. It's possible that one of the reasons they were doing the release of the medical records on Friday was to take attention away from this thing. I mean, you know, we can speculate about this to death. Who knows? But obviously both things are going on at once. And the bottom line here is that his health and his medical condition are going to be a big issue in this campaign. I think that's one of the things that's going to influence his decision on vice president and how people sort of react to who he selects as vice president.
Well, in the speculate to death department, Adam,
doing, by the way.
Which I love. I mean, we've got to figure that,
Charlie
Crist has got to be the front runner here. I mean, it's a no-brainer on Florida, it seems to me.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think geographically it makes sense. I'm not sure he has enough sort of experience to take the position or not.
He's got that healthy tan. He's got that healthy tan. He's really, you know, he's really relaxed. Come on.
You're jealous of his hair, aren't you?
Totally. Totally.
But very quickly, Adam, because we have to go in a second, but as you mentioned, these are not the only three on the list. Who else are you aware of that potentially could be on McCain's VP shortlist?
You know, with the sort of big caveat that, like, I could be wrong. One other person I keep a look on is Tim Pawlenty. He's the governor of Minnesota, and Rob Porter, and people mention Condoleezza Rice, but I'm a little skeptical. The thing is, like,
that's just a good story, Adam. Condoleezza Rice.
Yeah, it's just a good story,
and we could talk to you all day long, Adam Nagorny of the New York Times. But we got to move on. And so, many thanks for joining us this morning.
See ya.
All right, now to Israel. For the first time in 8 years, Israel and Syria are potentially negotiating a peace treaty. What does it mean? It's not unprecedented for Israel and Syria to be talking. It may be unprecedented that Turkey is mediating the talks. Joining us now is Ari Shavit, a very longtime political observer and columnist with the Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz. He joins us to discuss what are the implications of these talks. As I said, it's not unprecedented for Israel to talk to Syria. What do you think these talks are even about at this point?
Well, one has to see the context. For 8 years now, there were no peace negotiations, mainly because of the American position and the Israeli position. The Syrians have been wanting these negotiations for some time. And the strict position of the Bush administration with Mr. Sharon, Israel's previous prime minister, have prevented these negotiations. So we see here a shift that has to do with the coming elections in the United States, that towards the end of the life of this administration, there is a shift on the Israeli-American side, in a way. On the other hand, I think that there is, in a sense, you have to see here to make the distinction between substance and timing. There is some promise in the substance, because I think if you look at the long term, you do see real will, both on the Syrian side and the Israeli side, to explore the possibility. It's still very complicated and difficult. We can get into it.
Well, Ari, that's amazing that you say there is will, because we've just had, within the last few months, this airstrike by Israel in Syria, yet, as you say, there's still momentum for some long-term deal.
I think that what one has to understand about Syria is that this Syria is the weak part of the axis of evil or axis of militancy in the Middle East. It's not a natural partner of Iran, Hamas, and Hezbollah, because it's a secular country that actually wants something that is closer to the West rather than this Islamist radical approach. So there is some chance of taking Syria out of its treaty or alliance with Iran and the extremists. And yet it's very complicated to do that because Syria completely depends on Iran. Therefore, actually what Syria wants now is peace with America, not peace with Israel. It's perhaps willing to pay the price of peace with Israel so it can get legitimization from the United States. So America is the main partner. But this is the reason that I do not expect a real breakthrough right now, because Mr. Assad, the Syrian president, is actually waiting for the next American president, definitely if it's Senator Obama. And he will not go take the steps to a real treaty before the election of the new American president.
I suspect,
so what we see here now is a kind of foreplay, not the real game.
Is he also waiting for the next Israeli prime minister? Ehud Olmert is politically in trouble in Israel. It seems to me Bashar Assad should just wait it out.
Absolutely. Here you have to get into the cynical part of it. The timing here is not really, it has to do with cynical politics and with the spins rather than substance. Both Mr. Assad and Mr. Olmert are under extreme difficulties. Mr. Assad is under suspicion of being associated actually with the murder of the ex-prime minister of Lebanon, Mr. Hariri. Mr. Olmert is under suspicion of taking bribe. It was just released today that he got hundreds of thousands of dollars cash to the hand. So he's in deep, deep trouble. So you have two players who are actually exploiting the wish for peace in order to survive politically in the short term. But I think in the long term, their chances are brighter than what we see right now.
Weak players, very high stakes. I guess it's long-term optimism and short-term skepticism for those talks. Ari Shavit is a columnist at Haaretz newspaper. Thank you very much. He joined us from Israel.
It's more headlines now.
All roads from Damascus to Washington lead through Israel. That's what Ari was saying there. It's kind of interesting.
He was fascinating about the exploiting of peace, which is obviously difficult.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Once more, surging commodity prices are producing ripples around the globe. This morning, it's oil, $135 a barrel. Yesterday, we were marveling at $130 a barrel of oil. But it could also be any number of commodities. Rice, wheat, food prices have pushed past their records in a number of commodities over the last few months. And the question for us this morning is there a famine looming in fragile economies like Somalia? Global food prices have pushed that country even closer to the brink of famine by exacerbating the devastating effects of violence and chaos. The United Nations has declared a wide swath of central Somalia a humanitarian emergency, and that's just before declaring it a full-blown famine. We're joined from Nairobi, Kenya, by Christian Boslev Olsen, who's the head of UNICEF operations in Somalia. Christian, what forces are at work in Somalia right now producing what looks like an impending catastrophe?
Yes, we are at a brink of famine in Somalia just now. More than one-third of the total population in Somalia is totally dependent on international assistance, 2.6 million. And this is an increase of more than 40% just since 1st of January. So this is, unfortunately, an emergency situation that we have not experienced in the past 20 years in Somalia.
So, Christian, it is global forces that are driving this emergency in Somalia, not necessarily forces on the ground in the Horn of Africa, correct?
It's a number of things coming together. It is a global issue. We have seen increases in prices for food, basic food for families, up to 400%. And that, of course, is part of the global increase in food prices. And Somalia is dependent also in a normal year of import. But the extreme situation is also a local situation. We have the conflict. We have increased civil insecurity. We have fightings in many places. We have Mogadishu, nearly only half of the population is back in the capital. Most of them have left the capital. And then on top, it is an extreme dry season this year for the whole Horn of Africa. It's not just Somalia. So it's local and global. But the most concern to us just now is the actual security situation on the ground. We have extremely difficulties in accessing and assisting these 2.6 million people who is desperate in need of assistance from the international community.
So, Christian, there is a concern about food supplies, but from what you're saying, it really sounds like the people, the aid workers who are actually on the ground there are having difficulty even getting those supplies to the people who need them or ministering to those populations who are in great need. So it really is the security situation that is the major obstacle at this particular moment?
Yes, it is. And just to illustrate the situation on the ground, we have an increase in harassment of the civil population, but also direct attack on the aid agencies, NGOs, and UN. And just yesterday, we had another kidnapping of three colleagues from an international NGO working in Somalia. This year, we have had a total of 12 colleagues being killed inside Somalia. So
12.
The overall security situation is a very difficult one, and thereby to have access, to have people on the ground is extremely difficult for us.
Christian, is it an irony that as the price of food globally rises, it actually inflames the security situation because local militias and roving bands of people can make money, cash, off of commodities that normally weren't so expensive?
Yes. And you see that illustrated, unfortunately, in the market just a few weeks back in Mogadishu. You had heavy fightings between ordinary people and militias in the market because of the increase in prices. There was a number of people killed in that conflict. And that was not just part of politics and warlords and militias. It was a desperation of the prices of food for basic commodities in Mogadishu.
Christian, you've called Somalia the forgotten crisis. Why is that?
Number one, we are faced with the country with the worst indicators globally. If you compare to Iraq, Afghanistan, Darfur, you don't find so many people in desperate need like in Somalia for the time being. You don't find a place in the world where you have malnutrition rates up to 25-26%, nowhere in the world. And at the same time, you see very little attention, very little presence, and very little protection of the international aid workers and agencies and activities like in Somalia. That's the reason why we unfortunately have to label the situation in Somalia as the forgotten crisis.
Christian, one last question. Do you see the situation in Somalia, unique as it is, being replicated around the world as more and more nations find rising global food prices pushing them into a difficult security situation?
I don't hope, and I still insist that unfortunately Somalia, for Somalis, is a special case. But there are elements in the global situation where there is an added element of insecurity and conflict between, especially by the most vulnerable, by women, children, and families in this situation with increase of food prices globally.
Sounding the alarm, Christian Boslev Olsen, thank you very much. Christian Boslev Olsen is the head of UNICEF operations in Somalia. Now time for more headlines from Femi Oke.
Thanks, John. It's 28 minutes past the hour. Oil prices have rocketed to new highs again, and the Senate will vote on a bill to fund the Iraq war. Elsewhere around the world, two Palestinian groups have claimed responsibility for a truck bombing at the main crossing between Israel and Gaza. Israeli authorities say the truck blew up a few hundred meters before the target. The bomber was the only one killed. In the Republic of Georgia, partial returns and an exit poll show that President Mikhail Saakashvili and his ruling party is heading for a strong majority in the nation's parliamentary election. Opponents are challenging the results, which may set the stage for more political bickering. The death toll from last week's earthquake in central China has risen to 51,000, and more than 29,000 people are still missing. The government now may face protests from families whose children were killed in what they are saying are poorly constructed schools. Also in China, the three-day official mourning period for earthquake victims has ended, and the Olympic torch relay has begun once again. The torch's run through the hardest-hit province has been pushed back by 6 weeks, and the torch will now arrive in Sichuan just before the start of the Games on August the 8th. And it's all about the timing, John and Adora. Just when people may have forgotten the news story, they just highlight the area one more time.
Well, it recasts the whole torch ceremony. I mean, we were talking just a month ago about Tibet and protests, and it almost became comical, the amount of confrontation with the torch. Now it's a somber, almost funereal procession. It's really remarkable how it's changed.
And a big turnaround there as well.
Big turnaround, yep. Thank you, Femi Oke.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses two boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. I'm sure many of you remember that Minneapolis bridge collapse that killed 13 people. Well, there's a new report about it, citing that perhaps money concerns may have led to bad maintenance decisions, which then led to that collapse. That's just one major infrastructure catastrophe that's taken place over the last couple of years in New Orleans. The levees breaking in 2005 killed more than 1,000 people in the flooding. Boston's big digs falling concrete killed one woman. This has all triggered calls for overhauls of the nation's infrastructure. And, well, Jerry Bailenson, deputy editor for Popular Mechanics, responded and did a little investigation of his own, in fact, a year-long investigation. Jerry, many parts of this infrastructure are at great risk. What kind of structures are we talking about?
Sure. You know, it's a bit hard to pinpoint one bridge or one dam because we have so many that are in trouble. But a few places that we looked at were the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta in California. That's a place where very old and in some cases decrepit levees are holding back brackish water that would really contaminate the drinking water supply for most of the population of California. So that is a pretty serious problem that hasn't really been addressed in a meaningful way. The Wolf Creek Dam in Kentucky is very much weakened by erosion in its foundation. Now, that is being addressed, but the danger persists, and that dam really threatens Nashville and other communities downstream from it.
Jerry, I'm at 1 Center Street here in New York City, and over my shoulder is a bridge you may have heard of, the Brooklyn Bridge. How's that doing?
Well, the Brooklyn Bridge was actually something that we put on our list of bridges in trouble. The span itself is not in any danger of collapse, but the approaches to that bridge are not in very good shape. And one of the things that we really try to point out is that if we can't even keep the Brooklyn Bridge in good repair, what does it say about infrastructure throughout the rest of the country? It's really sort of indicative of just how little attention we pay to these issues.
And Jerry, you make a really good point. It's all about money, because ultimately, if we don't invest, the argument goes, we end up paying on the back end. Because this new bridge in Minneapolis, for example, is costing $400,000 a day, according to some estimates, in extra commuting time and gasoline, not to mention the cost of rebuilding the bridge. And to talk about some of these money issues, we're going to turn to Robert Puentes. He's a fellow at Brookings Institute. And you, very much like Jerry, say this is a dire situation. You describe transportation as among the top of among the most important issues that face American households, at first or second in cost, but that we're not putting the money behind proposals to minister to these infrastructures.
That's exactly right. We've had infrastructure in place that really has, it may have served us well in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. But the reality is, this is 21st century metropolitan America. We're a global society. Infrastructure has a very profoundly different role today than it does, or than it did just a couple of decades ago. But we really haven't had an intense discussion about what the role of infrastructure is, how it's connected to issues like economic competitiveness, environmental sustainability, social equity. We keep talking about transportation and infrastructure in general in their own kind of boxes. As if it's infrastructure for infrastructure's sake.
Well,
nobody gives a damn about infrastructure. They care about what it delivers. It delivers you to your job, or it delivers goods to home, and all these other things.
It also delivers coal to power plants. I read that 1920s-era locks are pretty much responsible for the delivery of coal to most of the power plants in the midsection of the country. What if that went down?
Absolutely. I mean, coal is just one example. Commuting patterns, you know, they used to be kind of the hub and spoke from suburbs down to center cities, you know, and this 9-to-5 kind of 50s era patterns are no longer the commuting patterns. We know most of them are suburb to suburb. We have 90 million people approximately that don't even have access to quality transit should they need it.
What's the price tag?
Aviation systems that are outdated. So the entire system just needs a real wake-up call, and we need the federal government to take the lead and to assess what's broken, what needs to be fixed, and where we're going to prioritize.
In terms of the political will, this is something that you talk about, Robert, because we are talking about hundreds of billions of dollars if you take into account the many places that need some help. In fact, the funding, in fact, is about to run out in October, and we'll get to that in a second. But the political will to do something, even in the wake of the Minneapolis bridge collapse, let's listen to what Congressman Jim Oberstar had to say when he was pleading with fellow members of Congress to invest in bridges.
If you're not prepared to invest an additional 5 cents in road reconstruction, bridge reconstruction, then God help you.
And so, Robert, where are we on the money? Are we indeed about to run out? And you see, it was not terribly successful in getting that 5 cents. I would anticipate getting more would even be more difficult.
Indeed, he certainly was not successful. And that was kind of emergency funding that was going to go to fixing the problem of the day, which was after the bridge fell down. But the Federal Highway Trust Fund, which is where the federal government gets its money to invest in transportation infrastructure, is the money in it is going down. We've been spending it down for a number of years because as the decades went on and people were consuming more gas and driving more, the revenues from the gas tax were going into the trust fund and we're having more and more money. The fact of the matter is people are actually driving less. They're consuming less gasoline with more fuel-efficient vehicles. There's not a whole lot of appetite for raising the gas tax, as we've seen from calls for the gas tax holiday and other things this summer. So the perfect storm on finance is hitting sometime at the end of this year when there's going to be less money in the Highway Trust Fund to pay for the authorizations that have come out of Congress. So there's a big gap right now, as you mentioned, in the billions of dollars.
A perfect storm. We'll have to leave it there. Jerry Balinson, deputy editor of Popular Mechanics magazine, and Robert Puentes, a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program of Brookings Institution. Interesting.
There, the sound of a single bugle playing taps, the traditional military funeral theme, which caused us to think a little bit about Memorial Day coming up, not in the context of higher gas prices and where people are going to travel, but in a specific sort of invitation we want to give to all of you.
Indeed. We looked back, did a little looking, and we found out that TAPS dates back to the Civil War. It was used then to commemorate soldiers, but also as a lights out for soldiers at nighttime.
And TAPS is certainly the theme of the notion of memorializing people who have died in wartime for Americans who are more connected to Memorial Day than perhaps their Weber grills. And we want you to memorialize someone for us on Monday. If there's someone important that you'll be remembering on Monday, we're opening up our SpinVox lines to help you do that. You can send your responses to 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we'll play them on the air, accompanied by a bugle and certainly accompanied by our thoughts and prayers.
Absolutely. Or you can send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We want to hear about who you will be commemorating on Memorial Day.
Memorial Day at the Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. What's our takeaway question today?
Our takeaway question is, in a dream world, if you could get paid for X, what would it be?
Fill in the blank. Here's the answer.
Good morning. My name is Troy Erickson. I'm calling from Grand Forks, North Dakota, and I wish I could get paid to make entries into my trivia journal. I keep a little journal book of obscure trivia questions. I write them down when they come up. And as long as we're dreaming, I would also like to get paid to spend time with my wife and my son. I'd like to get paid to lift weights, to make sarcastic remarks, and I would also like to get paid to eat.
That's a lot of jobs there, Troy. Troy, dude, from Grand Forks. We are huge in Grand Forks.
Thank you so much. We enjoy every day almost we get something from
them.
So thank you.
Thank you. Jason Poland would like to get paid for sketching the faces of all of the people in the city of New York. And he's sitting here actually working on that project. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you guys for having me.
So literally you want to sketch the faces of all 9 million, 8 million people in New York?
Yes, I do.
Because?
What are you wasting your time sitting around in the studio for then?
Well, I've been getting a couple of you guys while I've been in here.
That's good.
Yeah.
So why would you like to do this, Jason?
I thought it was a fun project that I could do to interact with New Yorkers.
Because you're kind of shy, right?
I'm a little bit shy.
I heard that.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought this was a way that I could maybe meet some people through my work.
But do you actually meet people? I mean, do you sort of sit on a perch somewhere and quickly sketch people that go by? Because we're not talking about portraits where
right.
an individual
a lot of
is
them
sitting
are very
for
quick.
Like 10 hours
yeah.
at a,
a
time.
A lot of them are very quick people walking by, but also there are people that I ask if I can draw them, and then after I draw them, I sometimes give them the drawing.
But you're kind of pulling an essence out of them, because some of your drawings are just 3 or 4 lines, and you can see the 500 you've got so far on everypersoninnewyork.blogspot.com. It's, you know, I was thinking about what you do, and I liken you, I think I referred to it earlier in the show, as a surveillance cartoonist. You're kind of there taking pictures of me, sketching pictures
yeah,
of me.
Yeah, a lot of them don't look that much like the person, but it's kind of a documentation mm-hmm. that I'm working on.
How long do you think this will take? And did you ever think perhaps starting with a city that has a few less people than New York? I mean, I don't know, maybe in Grand Forks, North Dakota, for example.
I need to go to North Dakota.
you started in Grand Forks. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm just going to work on it forever.
Oh, forever?
Yeah.
And put it into a book, or is this some yeah, kind
I was
of
thinking
personal
of maybe quarterly books to kind of keep people updated in book form, but also I have the website so people can check it every day if they'd like.
So, Jason, I'm suspecting that your mother says, "Oh, those are really nice cartoons." Now, are you going to get a job ever, Jason?
Well, I do freelance artwork. I do illustrations for magazines, and I do different work for companies like Jack Spade, mm-hmm. and I do all different things. This is kind of
so
one project
just,
that I'm working
this
on.
This is a passion project because obviously
oh,
you're
definitely.
Not making any money from
right.
it at all.
Right. Well, different. I've been getting different opportunities from different people through this project.
And
so
maybe
has,
you can get more for talking with us today.
Yeah.
What do you take away from the people that you sketch? What is it that you grab out of them, their essence, some quality that you see that maybe someone else doesn't?
Well, or what have you learned? And just to tag on to
I really like
there.
Drawing people when they don't notice me drawing them because they have certain poses and things that I think are natural things that I like to draw. And I guess I don't know if I'm taking that from them, but I'm learning maybe how people act in different situations.
You're catching
situations.
Them. It's a form of honesty and candor.
Well,
on
I'm
the
hoping
pages
it's not too aggressive.
Of Jason Poland. No, I can't imagine you being aggressive. Jason Poland.
Thank you very much.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, May 22nd, and we have some headlines for you from Femi. Femi, okay.
Hello, Adora Udoji, thank you very much. Just coming up to 12 minutes to the hour. This news just in the last few minutes. The number of newly laid off workers filing for unemployment benefits has fallen to the lowest level in a month. 365,000 people applied for benefits, and that's down by 9,000 people. Israel and Syria continue peace talks today. Israel says Syria must cut ties with Arab militant groups if it wants to reach peace. General David Petraeus is being promoted to head of all U.S. forces in the Middle East. Second-in-command Ray Odierno is in line to take over command in Iraq. President Bush has issued a challenge to Cuban President Raul Castro.
Since Raul is allowing Cubans to own mobile phones for the first time, we're going to change our regulations to allow Americans to send mobile phones to family members in Cuba. If Raul is serious about his so-called reforms, he will allow these phones to reach the Cuban people.
I wonder if President Castro refers to President Bush's George. New York Yankee pitcher Jarber Chamberlain has a new gig. The 22-year-old will join the Yankees' starting rotation. Chamberlain has dominated as a lights-out setup man. It's unclear when he will head to the rotation. And an update on a story that we covered last week on The Takeaway. Remember the polar bears in the Antarctic? Well, Alaska's Governor Sarah Palin is suing to have polar bears taken off the list of threatened species, claiming that their numbers are actually on the rise. And last week, the government placed polar bears on the endangered list because of their disappearing habitat, which has been linked to global warming. And finally, this newscast wouldn't be complete for a little bit of music. Rocker David Cook is the new American Idol. That's just a little snippet of him from last night on American Idol. 93 million people
97
voted.
97 million.
Voted.
Yes.
97
he
million
He won by 56%. It was quite something.
There's a fact that you need to keep quite in your mind.
Yeah. American Idol blows everything out.
Okay, no. We're going to move on to something else right now that's been blowing a lot of records out, and that is the race for president. The Democratic hopefuls, well, they're on the road today. Barack Obama is in Florida for a second day, trying to make inroads in that very important state in the general election. Hillary Clinton was there yesterday, too. Today, though, she's in Washington, D.C., before heading to South Dakota, which has a June 3rd primary. And this week, Clinton is continuing to make her case to count the votes from Florida and Michigan. Here's the senator speaking yesterday to voters in Boca Raton.
I remember when President Lyndon Johnson addressed the Congress and the nation, urging the passage of the Voting Rights Act. He declared, "I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy." It was urgent, elevated language, but it was not hyperbole. Now, as back then, those are the stakes.
Hillary Clinton's communications director, Howard Wolfson, for the campaign, joins us now. Howard, isn't comparing the rules from the DNC to the Voting Rights Act a bit of a stretch here?
Well, I think we have a principle in this country that when people vote, their votes ought to be counted. That's a bedrock principle of our country's democracy. It's a principle that many people have fought for over the years in many different contexts. None as importantly or dramatically as during the Voting Rights Act.
And it's a principle that apparently Harold Ickes of your campaign did not believe in when he voted to approve these rules 2 months ago.
Well, Harold Ickes isn't the candidate. And our candidate believes very strongly that the votes of Florida and Michigan ought to count. 2.5 million people voted in those primaries, the largest turnout in the history of the Florida Democratic Party. This was not a primary in which very few people came out. It was a primary in which a lot of people came out, a record number of people came out. And we believe that when people come out in those kinds of numbers, that their votes ought to be honored and rewarded in by counting them in the way they were cast.
Howard, I don't think anybody would dispute the principle, which is that every vote should count, but what I think I've heard many people say that's particularly troubling is that when you take a look at what happened in Florida and Michigan, it's not as if Hillary Clinton went there despite the ban, sort of in a protest and campaigned. This all came after the fact when Barack Obama seemed to be gaining speed. And so, therefore, now to, in addition to not having no sort of prior protest to this rule that was adopted, to compare it to what's happening in Zimbabwe or to the effort to free slaves in America just is perplexing and a bit disturbing to many.
Well, look, I think there was every expectation by everyone that we would have very low turnout in these primaries, that they wouldn't attract an awful lot of interest or a lot of voters, that having been told that their votes were not going to count, people would stay away from the polls. And in fact, the opposite happened. As I said, we had record turnout in Florida. We had a large turnout in Michigan. And I think people have to take notice of that. Let's put aside who made the decision to disallow Florida and Michigan. It was made by the DNC, but it obviously the elected officials in those states moved the primaries from dates that the DNC had approved.
So right, Howard, look, I love your point, but Adore's question was, if Hillary Clinton felt so emotionally connected to the enfranchisement of Florida voters, why didn't she campaign down there against the ban and say, forget the ban, we're campaigning in Florida and Michigan because we think it's ridiculous?
Because there was every expectation that the primaries there wouldn't count under the DNC's rules. There's no question about it that the DNC ruled that these primaries weren't going to count, and there was every expectation that they wouldn't. And if 10,000 people had come out, or 5,000 people, or no one had come out, the primaries wouldn't be counting.
Was there any discussion in the campaign about Voting Rights Act, the disenfranchisement in anticipation of the primaries, or is this just something that
came later?
Well,
there was an awful lot of discussion about the DNC's decision. The DNC's decision was what it was. I'm not going to criticize the DNC. But I think at this point, you know, you can ask about our motivations. You can ask about the Obama campaign's motivations. And by the way, the Obama campaign that claims to be for maximum participation has consistently stood against a revote in Florida and Michigan that both candidates could have participated in and campaigned in. So there are questions for the Obama campaign that I hope you get a chance to ask them. But let's put aside for a moment the motivations of the candidates. I'm going to argue for what my candidates' motivations are. You have appropriate tough questions about them. What do we do about the 2.5 million people who've come out and voted? What do we say to them? What is our obligation to those people? Putting aside the state officials, the candidates, or everyone else, what in our country do we do to honor and count the votes of people who voted?
Howard, I think that point is very well taken, and that's something obviously that the DNC is going to take up next week, or I believe on the 31st. But let's get back to your candidate. There are just three more primaries to go. She's headed off to South Dakota. Barack Obama has the majority of pledged delegates. You know, what are you hoping to see in the next week? What are you hoping will happen that would perhaps change the tide in Senator Clinton's favor?
Well, we do have three more primaries left, as you say, and I think we'll obviously have to do well in those primaries. The first one of them upcoming is Puerto Rico. We think that we will do well there, and we have to do well there. We did pretty well in Kentucky. We won by 35 points. We did pretty well in West Virginia. We won by 41 points. And that was at a time in which voters in those states were told that their votes were not particularly meaningful in the context of this primary process and that the contest had been decided. And despite that, we had big turnouts and a big victory. So we obviously have to do well in the upcoming states. And then I think clearly we're going to have to make the case to the superdelegates and to the voters in these upcoming states that Senator Clinton would be the best nominee against John McCain. And that's a case that you make based on the states that Senator Clinton has won, the key swing states that she's won, Florida, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, the fact that she's just racking up these large victories here at a time when people are being told that the race is over.
Howard Wolfson, director for the Hillary Clinton campaign, thank you. And I want to note that we got an email from George here who said, rightly points out that we really missed a good follow-up question in the Howard Wolfson interview. And he says, if only 10,000 people had voted, he was sort of paraphrasing what Wolfson said, of course no one would be fighting for their votes. So his question is, for 2 million voters you fight, but for 10,000 voters you ignore them. Where's the dividing line that makes it worth Clinton's time? And that's a good point. Thank you, George.
Clearly, the 2 million is a tantalizing number for the Hillary Clinton campaign at this point. We thank Howard Wolfson for joining us. Now, keep your responses coming to today's question, to anything that's happened on the program. Our takeaway question today was, in a dream world, I would get paid to do blank. You can send your answers to mytake@thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MYTAKE.
And Liz tells us she would provide free health care to those who can't afford it.
You can leave a comment at the takeaway.org page. While you're there, you can see the unpaid passion of our cartoonist, Jason Poland, who is trying to draw every person in New York City and succeeded in drawing the face of every person on our staff while he was here. So he got a few more. He got about 13 more.
And if you missed anything else on the show this morning, it's all on our podcast, and that's available on iTunes or on our website, the takeaway.org website.
I think he got your nose all wrong, Jason did.
Did
That's
he?
On the takeaway.
I don't
yeah.
think he got yeah. my nose. It was
no, he got it.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its American Worker Initiative. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.